Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And Dr. Buchwald, thank you so much for joining us today. So your book is examining the social construction of three Japanese territorial disputes. And I want to obviously get into all the details of that. But I wonder if you could tell us how you came to be interested in this project and specifically, you know, with these particular islands that that Japan is involved in territorial disputes about.
Thank you very much, Nathan. And please call me Alex. I think right. I'm more comfortable with that, if you don't mind. Thank you so much. It's great to be here on this podcast. So basically, I started, I guess, my PhD research was focused on Japan-Russia relations, focusing mostly on the Japanese side. So I explored the role of national identity, Japan's national identity, in Japan's Russia relations. And one of the territorial disputes that I examined in this project, it's one of the major stumbling stones in Japan's relations with Russia. So I was doing quite a bit of research on that. And from there, once I finished with my PhD and I was starting to get interested in Japan-Korea relations, I was studying Korean in Korea in 2006, I think it was, just when the dispute over Dr. Takeshima, 2005 it was, is when it flared up, but the demonstrations were still going on in Korea. And I was really, really puzzled by this nationwide passion in Korea over these islets, especially when I learned more about them. So I guess it developed from there. Yeah, this is, I guess, the kind of the short background for this project.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that you sort of came to this from the so-called Northern Territories dispute with Russia, in part because I think internationally that's probably the least known of the three. So I want to jump into the book itself and starting out with just some stuff that's in the introduction to get us started before we get into the chapters. Could you sort of outline the three disputes with the Northern Territories, as you said, Dr. Takeshima, and the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands? Who's involved? What are the disputes? Why should we care? I think a lot of our listeners are familiar, but probably not all. Also, if you would be could talk a little bit about a central contention of yours, which is relates to the role not of the states, but of the non-state actors that you call national identity entrepreneurs in your book. Could tell us what that means? Who are these people, and what is their role? And the last thing before we get started, could you talk about the origins of the disputes themselves? Right, because you talk about them in the book, highlighting the importance of the politics of the Cold War, but also like a sort of shock doctrine of, you know, crisis playing a major role in how these disputes become a part of the national discourse and the international politics.
All right, Nathan, I'll try to answer all of the three questions, which are quite complicated, I guess. I'll try to answer them all in one answer. So we're talking about basically three territorial disputes. All of them involve Japan. So if we start from the north, it's the Northern Territories or the Southern Kuriles, as they're known in Russia, which involved Russia, well, these disputes are pretty old. So I will get back to this in a second. So today they involve Russia and Japan. If we go a bit down, well, I guess south and to the west, it's the dispute over Dr. Takeshima between Japan and South Korea. We're talking about tiny rocks here. In the case of Northern Territory, sorry, I forgot to mention this, we're talking about four islands, two of them quite big, with 18,000 people living there. And if we go further south, we're talking about the dispute between Japan, China, and Taiwan over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. So these are eight islands. Today, nobody lives there. They're not inhabited, but they are definitely bigger than Dr. Takeshima. I mean, the overall territory, which are tiny rocks, though they do have Dr. Takeshima, they have about 60 Korean Coast Guards stationed there permanently. And until recently, Dr. Takeshima also had a Korean fisherman and his wife living there. The fisherman passed away, I think it was a couple of years ago, and I think the Korean government is still in the process of finding somebody to replace him. So these are the three disputes we're talking about, the disputes that I discuss in the book. When it comes to the origins of these disputes, what I'm doing in this book is I differentiate between the disputes themselves and the social construction of these disputes. So the disputes themselves, there've been quite a lot of works published on the history of the disputes, the state-to-state negotiations of the disputes. And I think most of the scholars agree that the disputes originated in the politics of the Cold War, or more precisely in the San Francisco Peace Treaty. In the case of Senkaku Diaoyu, we can also talk about the agreement on diversion of Okinawa to Japan, between Japan and the United States, signed in 1971. What do the politics of Cold War have to do with this? If you look at the San Francisco Peace Treaty, if we look at the article that deals with Japan's borders, this was a treaty that was supposed to delimitate Japan, the borders of post-war Japan. And all of the references, the article is very brief. And they are no specific and very vague at the same time, and that's why basically it leaves room for a lot for different interpretations. One of the reasons, the main reason for this ambiguity that has been raised by a few scholars and probably Professor Kimihara is one of the most well-known scholars that have worked on San Francisco Peace Treaty and this series of disputes, is that it was very much in the interest of the United States in the context of the Cold War to leave this ambiguity and this potential for certain frictions between Japan and its neighbors. I will not go into further detail because those listeners that are interested, they're most welcome to look up Professor Hara's book on the San Francisco Peace Treaty. It's all there, very well written and very interesting. But my interest is the social construction. So basically, I guess those familiar with the constructivist school of international relations would know what I mean about what I mean by social construction. Those that don't, basically, in a kind of simplified way, talking about this perception, widely spread perception regarding the importance of these territories for bilateral relations among not only the policymakers, but also among the general public. In the construction of this the social construction of these territorial disputes is a somewhat different process from the disputes themselves, or this is at least the way I see them. So, for example, let me give you an example. I'm reading a book on Japan-Korea relations, published by a prominent Korean, US-based Korean scholar. The book was published in 1985, Very well written book, very well balanced, very well researched, but it's not mentioning this Dr. Takeshima dispute at all. And this is not simply this is not a negligence on behalf of the scholar that wrote this book, but this is simply because this dispute was not seen as significant then by people in both Japan and people, scholars, policymakers in both Japan and Korea. So I'm looking. So my interest is in the social construction, basically how this idea that this territory, this disputed territory, is so important for the nation. How did it emerge, and how it gained such a prominence, such a widespread in the society? So this is what my book, my work, is interested in. And as you pointed out, I'm looking specifically at actors. These could be individuals, groups, at least in one case, it's a prefectural assembly, in the case of Takeshima in Japan. Actors that basically initiate this kind of debate, and they appeal to the nation. They frame this this dispute in terms of its national importance to the nation. And these are the actors that I refer to as national identity entrepreneurs. Another, point that you mentioned is that my argument is that this kind of activism by this national identity entrepreneurs tends to emerge during what I call critical junctures. So basically, these are times of crisis, times of certain social, economic, or political upheaval in the nation, which give rise these critical junctures. Usually, they have nothing to do with the disputes in question. But because of the way they impact the society, they enable the emergence of these kind of actors, these national identity entrepreneurs, who then use these disputed territories as a rhetorical tool, as a framing instrument, in making a certain claim, in appealing to the people, to the state. I think I'll stop here for now.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's really helpful. And thank you for dealing with all those questions tossed at you at once. I thought it was very helpful for me, having read the book, to hear that anecdote about the 1985 book that you're reading, because it just does highlight how some of these things are of such, that they are a product of a particular time, right? That they're and even though they're often not treated that way. You talked in your answer. You began to sort of stake out your position within the field of international relations. I wonder if there's anything else that specifically that you'd like to say about that, about sort of the way you frame your project within that field and stake out your own territory, so to speak.
Yes. I would locate my research within the constructivist school of international relations. And in a nutshell, constructivist school of international relations basically argues that states' actions, they obviously derivative of states' interests, but these interests are not a given. These interests are shaped by national identities. So in specific time, depending on the country, these identities shape interests in a certain way. And from these interests, certain policies evolve. So my intervention is it's twofold. One is that basically my argument is this: identities, and there are some good, some not so good works on identity and international and foreign policies in East Asia, of Japan, of Korea. But quite often these identities are treated as monolithical, as something that emerges as a whole or exists as a whole. And my argument is that these identities, these discourses of identity, are made of specific narratives. In the case of, obviously, in the case of territorial disputes, these are narratives about these disputed territories. And these narratives, they're activated by certain actors, very specific actors, at a certain time in history, for specific reasons. And in order to understand how actually national identities that in turn shape policy, interests and policies, how these identities emerge, how they created, how certain discourses are sustained, recreated, we need to understand how these specific narratives that can be seen as building blocks of this broader national identity constructs, how they emerge and how they become diffused in society. How do they reach this, you know, this status of being part of this level of becoming part of national identity? So this is one point, focusing on specific narratives and basically looking at the process rather than at final outcome of national identity, looking at the process of how it is constructed, how it is created. Another point is that in international relations, quite often, I mean, again, I'm referring to the constructivist school, when scholars talk about national identity, they tend to conflate the nation and the state. So basically, when they look for evidence of national identity, quite often they would look at some governmental documents, statements made by politicians. They will also look at some writings by, nationalistic scholars, public opinion leaders, etc. So the nation and the state is basically seen very much as one in the scholarship. And what I'm trying to argue here, again, by focusing on those national identity entrepreneurs that talked about just before, is to argue that the process of national identity construction is much more complex. Quite often it's contentious. Basically, it's this contention between this national identity entrepreneurs and the state through which national identities emerge. So we need to differentiate between the state and those people that see themselves as representing the nation. I'm not arguing that this is true for all cases, but at least for the cases that I'm looking at here. So these are two points. And also, if we maybe not so much as broader international relations scholarship, but specifically scholarship that focuses on territorial disputes in international relations, but also, I guess, maybe history. There's a certain, state centrism. So basically, when people talk about territorial disputes, the focus is mostly on the state. And what I'm trying to show here is that I'm trying to move away from the state. So it's the state centrism. I'm trying to look at other actors, non-state actors. Again, these are those identity entrepreneurs. And explore their role in the construction, in this complex process of construction of these narratives and national identities.
Yeah, thank you. That's extremely helpful and very clear. And I think it also, for me, was, you know, those interventions, even though I'm looking at the book from the field of history, were, you know, particularly poignant, because a lot of what we've sort of, you know, the way that thinking about Japanese, the history of Japanese empire, for example, has evolved in somewhat the same way, right? From thinking about it as this sort of, you know, top-down state-led process to really thinking about the ways that these, you know, non-state bottom-up actors are creating foment in some places. And of course, you know, there's lots of case by case that goes with this, but the sort of shift in focus is something that I recognized from my own discipline as well, and was very helpful for me in sort of seeing how your book is put together. So I want to jump into that, into the heart of the book, which is the chapter. So the first one, chapter one, is Japan's Northern Territories. And as I said in the intro, I think, I mean, the dispute with Russia is probably internationally the least well-known of Japan's territorial disputes over the so-called Northern Islands. And those are the islands that were occupied by the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. In your chapter, you highlight the role of the mayor, Ando Ishisuke, the mayor of Nemuro in Hokkaido, as one of these entrepreneurs, and you show how what the very imaginatively named Commission for Entreating the Return of Islands Attached to Hokkaido, which Ando created, began drafting petitions to the U.S. occupation almost immediately after Japan's surrender. So can you tell us about that, the sort of, you know, long history of this throughout the post-war, about why Nemuro and, you know, how Ando becomes the sort of, you know, entrepreneur, you know, par excellence here, and about how the issue has evolved over the interceding decades. I'm particularly interested in the sort of relevance of another national identity entrepreneur, the Nemuro area Peace Preservation and Revival Alliance under a guy named Tohachi Mamoru, and how he shifts the focus from territorial to economic rights, and how that sort of plays out, and it becomes there becomes tension between the prefectural and national governments. And as you point out, there is this significant tension between Hokkaido and Tokyo about this. So how does that all play out from across the post-war?
Okay, well, thank you, Nathan. It's a very complex issue. I think the dispute between the territorial dispute between Japan and Russia is the least known today, or let's put it this way, it's the least one that's in the news these days, because there's not much happening there actually, which is probably good. I guess from Japan's perspective, well, it's a difficult question whether that's in terms of territory. This is basically, we're talking about the largest territory. These northern territories are the only islands that actually have a permanent population. And in the case of the northern territories, we're talking about at least I think these days it's about 18,000-19,000 people, Russian citizens residing there. Fisheries. Timber, potential for some gas and oil. So it's in terms of resources. So we're talking about relatively significant territory here, especially compared to the other groups of islands. But Nemuro is definitely considered as the birthplace of the movement for the return of Northern Territories, and the reason for this is that it's quite simple, because Nemuro had the most important economic connection with the disputed islands before they became disputed. They were under Japan's jurisdiction until the Soviet occupation in late August, early September 1945. So Nemuro is basically, you had people who owned certain property on those islands, people who had relatives on those islands. So there was a very strong economic connection between Nemuro and if the listeners would like to have a look on the map of Japan and its position, Nemuro's position, they will see that basically it's very, very close. You can see, I think, the closest island, within this group of the disputed islands, is probably about 3 kilometers from Nemuro. So on a clear day, you can actually see it. So you can see Russia from Nemuro. Nemuro is actually, so this is where most of the Soviet Union, where after occupying the islands, basically expelled all of the Japanese residents. There were about 15,000-16,000 Japanese living there at that point. So many of them, quite a few, I think about 10,000 of them, I don't have the exact figures now, settled in Nemuro. And also because of the economic importance of Nemuro, these islands for Nemuro, it's not only the islands themselves, it's also the waters where Nemuro's economy has been focused on fisheries. And this is where this is where Nemuro fishermen were conducting their fishing activities. So this is, I think, the main reason, basically economic connection, economic and people connection to this islands. This is why this movement is started in Nemuro. Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm focusing. There are many groups, many small groups that appeared and disappeared. But one of the groups, both of the groups that you mentioned, these two groups are the main focus of this chapter. One of the groups was established by Ando Ishizuke, who was the mayor of Nemuro at that time. It's not completely clear. There is certain archival material, there's certain documents left by these groups and memoirs that I was able to work with. It's not completely clear the motives for his activism, but he was positioning himself as a champion of the nation and the champion of Nemuro. But he also had certain personal interests there. He was running a farm and I think a crab cannery on one of the islands. So there was some personal interest in it. Also, because he was the mayor of Nemuro, and we're talking about Japan in mid-1940s, 1945 till about 1950-56. This is when the when this group was active. So we're talking about pretty dire economic conditions, and we have the addition of those expelled residents who settled there. So the main reason has been, I guess, there was some personal interest, but also economic hardship for the town. Another group which was established in early 1950s, which was also in Nemuro, it was quite different. Well, quite interesting, I think, the contrast between the two groups. It was established by Togashi Mamoru, who was, if Ando was very much a typical pre-1945 Japanese local politician, quite conservative. Togashi Mamoru was also a local politician, but he was basically on the left. He was at a certain time member of the Socialist Party, so he had close connections with the Socialist Party. He was more of a union activist turned politician. If the first group, Ando's group, was basically framing the argument in terms of these are, our inherent territories developed, so very quite strongly nationalistic, developed by, blood and tears of our forefathers. The group established by Togashi was, and their argument, in both cases, I think the main motive, the main motivation for the activism was improving the livelihoods of people of Nemuro. But for Togashi, basically, he was framing the argument or framing his position simply, purely in economic terms. Basically, his argument was we need to do everything we can to alleviate the economic conditions of people of Nemuro. And he was urging the government to adopt a flexible position on the territories, on the return of the territories, on the scope of the territories, as long as the people of, Japan, but by default also the people of Nemuro, will be able to trade with the Soviet Union and China, and they will be able to engage in fishing activities in those waters around the disputed islands. We also have another quite important actor here. This is the Hokkaido Prefecture, Hokkaido Prefectural Governor Tanaka, who was a socialist, member of the Socialist Party, and he is basically the way I interpret his interest in this. He was basically leading the prefecture's engagement with the dispute. I think that for Tanaka Toshifumi, it had very much to do with the conflicts he was engaged with. Tokyo was the central government at the time. Basically, Tanaka was one of the few socialist governors of Japanese prefectures, and the government, the central government at that time is obviously the head of the conservatives, what will eventually become the LDP. So the conservatives, they want to establish Hokkaido Development Agency, which would become somewhat of a parallel agent of governance, basically wrestling some of the authority and obviously finance away from the prefecture, Hokkaido Prefecture. And obviously Tanaka is opposing, is very strongly opposing this kind of development, very critical of this. So the way I interpret this, and again, there are some, this is very much an interpretivist argument. I wouldn't say that I couldn't find any evidence where Tanaka would explicitly say that this is what motivated him to embrace this, Northern Territories goes. But I think there's enough evidence, which I bring up in the book, which shows that this could have been the case. That my interpretation is not too far-fetched. Basically, he's using the dispute to criticize the government. He's using the dispute to criticize the government's policies, using the dispute to criticize to say the government is giving away those islands. So he's using these territories to criticize and to enhance his legitimacy in Hokkaido, but also probably in Japan. He conducted a few demonstrations, a few protests. He participated, organized a few protests in Tokyo. So he was trying at least to bring this, this dispute to Tokyo and to appeal to the people in Tokyo. I can't say that he was very successful in that. The government initially doesn't pay much attention to this to these territories, to this dispute between it and the Soviet Union. Obviously, doesn't pay much attention to these groups. These groups are small. Doesn't pay much attention to Hokkaido Prefecture as well. In 55, 56, Japan and the Soviet Union they try to negotiate a peace treaty, they fail. But from then onwards, there's only just a joint statement. But the government is not that much interested in these territories overall. It's only from late night, and most of these groups, there's certain groups of former residents that continue to exist. The two groups that activist groups that I just talked about, now they cease to exist after the Soviet-Japan negotiations in 1955-56. There are obviously a few groups of former residents that continue to exist. From 1960s, late 1960s, the government starts to pay quite an increasing attention to this dispute, embarks on a fully-fledged domestic campaign, posters, certain facilities, educational so-called enlightenment campaign towards the citizens about this territory occupied by the Soviet Union, arguing for the need for all the people to unite, to work together towards their return. And why? The question is obviously why from late 1960s and early 1970s the government suddenly becomes so interested in these islands. The argument I'm making here that it has to do with the return of Okinawa. Basically, from 1969 till 71, the government negotiates the return of Okinawa, which is at that time occupied by the United States. But Okinawa returns with American bases, and this is something that is criticized by the socialist opposition, heavily criticized, The argument I'm trying to make here is that the government decided, or shifted its attention to northern territories and embarked on this excessive campaign, is basically had very, cynical, I guess, political calculations aimed at diverting people's attention from Okinawa towards the north, towards the Soviet Union, which is obviously Japan's enemy anyway in the Cold War. And at the same time, as part of the process in this campaign, the government also co-opts some of the groups, the existing groups of former residents, and it also adopts some of the strategies and some of the arguments made by the activists in late 1940s, 1950s. So in this case, basically, we see that the narrative about Northern Territories was mostly created by the central government. So the role of this national identity entrepreneurs was rather limited. But at the same time, I'm arguing that the government has adopted quite a few of their strategies and the arguments, so we cannot disregard the role here completely.
Yeah, thank you for sort of unpacking that, because it's a very complicated story, right? With all these different vectors, you have the prefectural government, you have the local socialists, and so that's very helpful to sort of see it that way. And it's also interesting how it contrasts, and yet there's some interesting parallels with what's happening in Chapter 2, which is Shimane Prefecture's quest for Takeshima. And that's about the Dokto Takeshima dispute. A good deal of the chapter is looking at the prehistory of Takeshima Day, which was declared by Shimane in 2005. So you show that the prefecture's interests in these, basically barren islands had little to do with territory and a lot to do with economics. And so that has obviously some parallels with the Northern Territories. But that's early on, and that eventually Shimane Prefecture turned into a national identity entrepreneur with national territory being sort of leveraged as a symbol, again, of injustice inflicted upon the prefecture by Tokyo. And along the way, you talk about some fascinating parallels with the Northern Territories issues, which I hope you'll bring up, and point out the sort of critical juncture in the early 2000s with the Koizumi administration and its reforms, which create the immediate sort of proximal conditions for Takeshima Day. So tell us about that and about the fallout from that 2005 decision.
Thank you, Nathan. So Takeshima, if we look very briefly at the history, and I will refer to Takeshima here because this is the Japanese name of this two rocks, this islet. So the Korean name is Dokto. If we look very briefly at the history, basically Takeshima was incorporated into Shimane Prefecture in 1905. Today, the Korean position argues that Takeshima's incorporation was the first step in Japan's colonization of the whole of peninsula. And the Japanese position is that this had nothing to do with, this was a confirmation of previous possession. Had nothing to do with the colonization of the Korean Peninsula. So again, the history is quite complex. But basically, and I will not, I will try to avoid like all the details here. There are lots of dates and names involved. But basically, from the early post-war years, Shimane Prefecture lobbies the central government to do something about Takeshima, because Takeshima, firstly, is placed outside of the so-called MacArthur Line, so the Japanese fishermen are prevented from going there. And just when the San Francisco Peace Treaty is about to come into effect, the Koreans basically established control, de facto control over these islands. And since then, so since 1951, 52, these islands have been under Korean control, de facto administration. So Shimane Prefecture lobbies the government to establish control over these two islands, two rocks. And Japan's the government's position is identical. The government is lobbying, also is lobbying the Americans during the negotiations of the San Francisco Peace Treaty. So the prefecture and the government, basically, they are on this, they share the same position. This changes after 1965, after Japan and Korea sign a normalization treaty, peace treaty, you can call it as well, in which both sides decide to shelve the dispute. They decide to shelve the dispute for a variety of reasons, mostly related to domestic politics in both countries. But from 1965 onwards, basically, the Japanese government is not paying any attention to Takeshima. It's not paying. It's hardly appearing in any policy documents. Occasionally, you hear certain politicians make certain statements, but overall, the government's basically ignoring this issue. And this is probably the main reason. And the issue is not playing any important role in bilateral relations as well. The Japan and Korea, they have a fisheries treaty, which is signed also in 1965, which basically enables more or less with certain hiccups here and there, but overall generally smooth fishing activities by fishermen from both sides. So from 1965, basically, Shimane continues to argue for establishing, at least on this point, it's in opposition to the government. It continues demanding from the government to do something about this, basically, to establish Japan's territorial rights over these islands. Why is Shimane so preoccupied? I wouldn't call it preoccupied. The issue also is it has been playing a central role on the prefectural agenda. But Shimane Prefecture, every year in its annual appeals to the government, it demands the establishment of the territorial rights to Takeshima. And the reason for this, I argue, has to do a lot with northern territories. Not the dispute itself, but the governmental campaign, northern or domestic campaign related to northern territories. So basically, the government, as we just saw in the previous chapter, the government embarks on this extensive campaign. Lots of money are being spent on, and Shimane, which basically has its claims to Takeshima, is not getting anything. Though formally, a government's position on both of the disputes is identical. So I'm arguing that gradually the question of Takeshima becomes an issue of, identity or injustice for Shimane Prefecture. This basically this kind of injustice inflicted upon it by the central government. And there are quite a few developments in late 1980s, 1990s, when the two governments have to renegotiate the fisheries treaty. But I guess the most important point, especially if we think about the central role the dispute is playing in Japan-Korea relations today, is the 2005 Takeshima Day Ordinance adopted by Shimane Prefecture. And quite often, certain analysts, certain pundits, especially in Korea, have argued that this was basically done on behalf of the central government. But actually, if we look at documents and if we look at what has been happening between the central government, between Tokyo and Shimane Prefecture in months preceding the ordinance, we see that the government is trying to put pressure on Shimane Prefecture not to pass this ordinance. So the government is not happy with it. The government is trying to, take certain steps to prevent it, but it fails. Obviously, it fails. So what's happening? So why is Shimane Prefecture, why this issue reignites in Shimane Prefecture in early 2000s? It's reignited in Shimane Prefecture in the late 2000s. And this is the main one of the questions I'm trying to answer here. And my answer is that, yes, obviously the kind of there was some tensions building up in Japan in bilateral state-to-state relations leading to this over Takeshima. But probably the most important factor here is Koizumi reforms. This is the critical juncture that I emphasize here. So what is it about the Koizumi reforms? And again, if we look at Koizumi reforms, basically we'll look at this attempt to... There are quite a few, as I could, the so-called Trinity reforms are basically looking at, privatization of postal office, but also trying to decrease the prefecture's dependence on central government. So more autonomy for prefectures, but also less budget, less allocations, monetary allocations to them from the center, from Tokyo. And Shimane Prefecture has been one of the poorest prefectures in Japan all the way throughout the post-war years, quite heavily dependent on those budgetary allocations for its own budget. So looking at the debates inside Shimane Prefecture among the local assembly lawmakers, basically, I'm arguing that it was very much a response to Koizumi, reforms initiated by Koizumi, very much which enhanced the sense of injustice among Shimane Prefecture's elites. This was very much the ordinance was very much a kind of a revolt against the central government. It was also at the same time, it was a revolt against Koizumi reforms, but it was also, in a somewhat ironic fashion, I guess, enabled by Koizumi reforms. Why? Because if we look at the composition of the prefectural assembly in 2004, 2005, and probably even today, it's mostly LDP. So basically, we see local, prefectural level LDP members rebelling against LDP-led government. And how is this possible? My argument here is that Koizumi reforms, basically they created, because Koizumi went out against the dominant fraction inside the LDP, there was quite a bit of different struggles and inside the LDP during that time. And I'm arguing that basically it's crisis management mechanism that would have prevented the emergence of this kind of ordinance in different times, just failed to function. So this is more or less the argument I'm making about the road to Takeshima Bay in Japan.
Yeah, that's really what was one of the things that was really fascinating to me was that internal dispute within the ruling Liberal Democratic Party between, it's one thing when in Hokkaido you have a socialist governor who's, putting the prefecture in tension with the central government, which is ruled by the Conservative Party, which calls itself the LDP. But it's quite another thing when, in Shimane, you have an internal LDP sort of internecine dispute here. So I found that rather fascinating. In chapter three, you're taking on the other side of this issue, not the Takeshima side, but the Dokdo side, in a chapter called The Protect Dokdo Movement in South Korea. And you argue that the early campaigns to the Protect Dokdo campaigns drew on what you call counter-hegemonic historical narrative and an alternative national identity construct centered on a concept of the people or Minjong as sort of an anti-elite. And though the movement initially solidifies around a response to threats to South Korean national identity posed by the sort of critical juncture in the late 1990s, that's the IMF crisis. Since 2005, the Protect Dokdo movement has been partially co-opted by the government. To add to this, I mean, you make the fascinating point that even though the provincial government of North Gyeongsang was heavily involved, as you put it, in the production and reproduction of the Dokdo is our land construct, its role is quite different from that of Shimane. So, and this chapter has a really rich cast of national identity entrepreneurs. So it'd be great if you could maybe reference one or two of them as you sort of lay out this story for us.
Thank you, Nathan. I think if we look at the doctor narrative today in South Korea, the government is definitely one of the main, if not the main, actors that engage in its production and reproduction. You can see campaigns on trains, posters everywhere, pamphlets being published in different languages about how doctor is Korea's land, and about Japan's unlawful, preposterous claims to it. But if we look at the history of the movement to protect doctor, what we find there is basically, again, we find those basically activists who initially emerge as critics of the government, and basically the whole movement is equally critical of the Korean government as it is of Japan's claims to the islands. So what I'm trying to do in this chapter is basically to look at the origins of this movement and trying to analyze how this movement emerged and to understand the claims that it was making. Why did it emerge in a bit earlier probably, but it started to become kind of a mass movement in late 1990s. So this is my main goal in this chapter. And my argument, in a nutshell, I guess in one sentence, my argument is that the movement to protect doctor was very much a continuation of the pro-democracy movement of 1970s and 1980s. So how the two movements related? So first of all, they very simply, I mean, we see very much same people, the actors. So if we look at the leaders of the of the Protect Doctor movement, we can see that many of them were very active in the students in the pro-democracy movement in 1980s Korea. And one of these people that I interviewed for this book, one of the leaders of one of the groups, which exists until the present day, in a much smaller form though, he was Mr. Che Chae-ik. He was a student activist back in the 80s. He was a socialist. He calls himself these days a national socialist, which I don't think, nationalist socialist. I don't think he's making any references there to National Socialist Party in Germany in the 1930s. He's quite an interesting character. Basically, he looks after a kindergarten which is owned by his wife, and he is driving the kids back and forth from home to the kindergarten. But he sees his main job, his main kind of main occupation as doctor protector. Student activists back in the 80s, as I mentioned, did a master's degree at one of Korea's leading universities. Then he worked as a newspaper reporter for a while. But I think basically my understanding is that he was running a cram school for a while. He became victim of the so-called IMF crisis, which I'll talk about soon in 1997-98. And since then, he has devoted himself to this movement. So in terms of his ideas also, we see a lot of parallels with the democratization movement. And what are the parallels that I'm talking about here? We need to understand basically this, We need to understand the what kind of national identity vision the democratization movement has had for Korea, the democratic opposition in the 1980s. So it was very ethnically focused. So basically, very focused on the ethnicity, on the ethnic nation. One of its main tenets was this dichotomy between the people and the elites. So not dissimilar. Basically, the oppressed versus the oppressor. Not dissimilar to this multitude and empire distinction dichotomy made by Hart and Negri in their much more recent work. But basically, who are the people? Who are the elites? The elites are those that oppress the nation. They conspire together with outside forces, Japan and the United States in this case. The people are being exploited. The people are being duped. Basically, they look at the nation also as the ethnic nation that spreads through the whole of Korean Peninsula. So basically, they think that the argument is that democratization, basically getting rid of those corrupt elites that oppress the people, will bring national unification as well. So for them, democratization and unification. So they're quite Marxist. They certainly have a very strong influence of Marxism, or probably more like Latin American Marxism, the dependency theory kind of Marxism on their thought. But basically, their vision is that democratization will bring unification, and all this will lead to the establishment of Korean subjectivity as an independent and autonomous nation. The democratic movement actually wins. They defeat Cheonduan. Korea has a new, so the student protests in 1987, they bring eventually to the new constitution. But in a somewhat, again, quite ironically, they win in terms of the political struggle, but their vision of national identity for newly democratic Korea collapses completely as well. Why? So, well, first of all, 1990s, we see the collapse of communism. So overall, this kind of leftist ideas globally, but also obviously in Korea, they lose their... To a certain extent, I guess, lose their legitimacy, lose their appeal. Korea is democratized, but unification is as distant as it was before, though there are certain movements, but obviously Korea is not unified, and the prospects of unification are still quite dim in the 1990s. The new democratic governments, successive governments in Korea, they continue to maintain close relations with the United States. And I think probably the kind of the key moment here is the 1997 financial crisis, which is called in Korea the IMF crisis, because Korea had to get bailed by the IMF. Besides the horrible consequences the crisis had for Korean society and economy, basically it just highlights for the Koreans how embedded Korea is in international, how deeply embedded it is in international capitalist economy. So this is where I see the roots of this doctor movement. And I'm arguing that basically in a way the shifting of focus to doctor rather than to democratization and unification as it was in the original democratization movement enables its recreation of this discourse, of this narrative of Korean national identity by again deferring its final creation to the future, but also by getting rid of this various Marxist elements in the discourse. So, for example, the people elites dichotomy remains the same very much in the discourse. Again, the Protect Doctor movement emphasizes the people and their connection to the doctor. Doctor is seen now as the embodiment of the Korean nation. So basically, doctor equals Korean nation. Doctor is the symbol of national subjectivity. People, elites, domestic elites conspire with Japan. They about to give up doctor to the Japanese. So this dichotomy is maintained. But again, Marxism, all this kind of Marxist elements that's talked about, the economy, economic exploitation, etc., disappear here. And democratization and oppression, they are replaced with territorial consciousness of the people. And the kind of the corruption and flunkyism of the elites. And they argue that if the people basically now, instead of being of democracy, of democratization, basically the narrative argues that getting rid of, for the people to get rid of the corrupt elites, but also to gain proper territorial consciousness, get rid of the corrupt elites. This is the key to national liberation. So this is the argument I'm making here, basically showing these parallels between the two discourses, and trying to show that this the discourse about doctor was very much a recreation of the democratization movement narrative about Korea's national identity.
Yeah, and I thought the story is, you know, the story of the way that those energies get transferred over from democratization to Protect Dokdo is a really fascinating one. And it was something that I was entirely unaware of until I read the book. And actually, there was something in chapter 4 also, which is Taiwan's Protect the Diao Tai movement that I was equally unaware of, which is precisely that it was Taiwan's Protect the Diao Tai movement. So the final chapter is engaging with this dispute over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And I think a lot of people like myself probably associate this issue most closely with the recent public clashes between Japan and the PRC. But your chapter points out that the whole Protect the Diaoyu Tai movement originates in the politics of Taiwan and its sort of complex web of relationships, Cold War relationships with the PRC, the US, and Japan. So in this chapter, you write that the islands became a focal point for questions about the legitimacy of both the nationalist and the communist governments, and then reemerge in post-democratized Taiwan, where, as you put it, the framing of the dispute as a symbol of humiliation suffered by the Chinese nation at the hands of Japanese imperialists had remained intact. However, in the context, in this new context, the implications of this national identity, entrepreneurship, and political role of the narrative espoused by the activists changed significantly. So can you tell us sort of what the dispute has meant for these various parties and how it changed over time? And especially if there are, you know, parallels or specific contrasts that you'd like to bring out with the other chapters.
Yes, I think the Bao Diao movement is quite unique in among all of the case studies as I examine in my book for a variety of reasons. So first of all, you're absolutely right. Today, the importance of the dispute, or the dispute, is mostly between Japan and China, PRC. Taiwan plays a certain role, but marginal role in the dispute today. But the dispute, again, it originates, the movement, so this the Bao Diao, the Protect the Diao Yu Tai movement originated in Taiwan. Or to be more precise, and this is another unique, I think, characteristic of this movement, are Taiwanese students in the United States. So, and another, I think, interesting point about this dispute is that in all of the three cases that I examined that we just talked about before, so the Northern Territories, Takeshima in Japan, and Dokdo in Korea, these are narratives about these islands. They become quite central to national identity discourses in the two countries. In the case of Baotiao, the narrative created by the activists back in the 1970s, and the dispute itself is rather marginal in today's Taiwan's discourse on national identity. So there are there's certain characteristics here that certain quite a few points that make this dispute quite unique. So why? What happened in 1970? The initial movement was quite short lived, 1970 to 1974. But most of the groups ceased to exist by 72 already. Basically, we're talking about islands that were administered. The Diaoyudo Islands were administered by the United States as part of Okinawa Prefecture after World War II. And there are two quite important developments that trigger the movement. One is this ECAFEO, this is basically United Nations commissioned study in 1968 that find some oil, or basically they say that there's a possibility of oil reserves in waters surrounding the islands. And in 1969, Nixon, President Nixon and Sato, Prime Minister Sato of Japan, they issue a declaration, Sato Isaku, they issue a declaration in which basically the United States promises the return of Okinawa with the island as part of Okinawa Prefecture, obviously, return them all to Japan. So these are two immediate triggers, but again, so the movement is initiated by students, by Taiwanese students in the United States, across the university students in the United States, who establish various Protect the Diaoyutai action committees in different universities, So why the United States and why, what exactly, what are the critical junctures that we're talking about here that trigger this movement? So obviously the immediate triggers are this study and the Nixon-Sato declaration. But I'm trying to dig a bit deeper here. So one obviously very important, I think, critical juncture is nothing to do with Taiwan, actually, or Japan or China, is the so-called long 1960s in the United States. So there's a decade of activism, of campus activism in the United States, all those anti-war movements, civil rights movements, and these movements, these groups definitely influence the Taiwanese students. They're coming from dictatorial Taiwan, something that's, they couldn't have imagined to engage in this kind of activism. So this is something that I think plays quite an important role in igniting this activism. But another important critical juncture here, I think, is basically, again, the crisis in Taiwan's, at that time, it's basically Chinese national identity on Taiwan. So when Chiang Kai-shek, when he escapes to Taiwan, basically his vision of Taiwan is temporary shelter before he recaptures, before he gets to return and recaptures the mainland. His position is that they came to the Kuomintang, the only and the sole legitimate government of the whole of China. And he embarks on this process of sinification of Taiwan. So Taiwan basically was a Japanese colony for 50 years, with all that comes out of it, language, culture, etc. But basically, Chiang Kai-shek and KMT, they engage in this re-sinification of Taiwan. So Mandarin is imposed as the national language. Streets are renamed after places on mainland. Maps that students, kids see at school, they're basically maps of the whole of China. And if we think about the generation of those students, university students in early 1970s, so basically these, I guess, are people about 18, 19, 20 years old. So this is the first generation of Taiwanese, most of them are of mainland descent, so most of them they are from, because these are quite the elites. These are children of people who escaped from mainland together with the KMT after their defeat by the communists. So this is the first generation of people who were brought up, basically, they were brought up on Taiwan, but they were brought up as Chinese, basically. They saw that, you know, that they believed that Taiwan is the legitimate China, the only China, that the escape to Taiwan is only temporary. And they learned to imagine their nation as basically standing for the whole of China. This generation, this is the generation, basically the first generation that has been socialized into this kind of identity. And this myth, this kind of the myth or this identity has been sustained very much by the politics of the Cold War politics. And what I mean by politics of Cold War here is basically the fact that Taiwan or the ROC Republic of China has occupied China's seat on the United Nations. It represented China in all the international organizations. So basically this mythology, this myth of Taiwan as a Republic of China, as being the only China, the real China, has been maintained. And as a result of, all these developments are obviously related to each other. So the Sato-Nixon declaration and at the same time, what's happening in late 1960s, early 1970s, is this rapprochement between the United States in mainland China, PRC, the communist China. So what we see is the beginning of the collapse of this mythology in early 1970s, of this idea that Taiwan is, ROC, Republic of China, is the only China, the only legitimate China. Taiwan has been kicked out of the United Nations. So my argument is that this Bao Diao movement was very much a response to this crisis, crisis of Chinese national identity by Taiwanese students. And as a result, so the different groups, there were left-leaning groups, centrist groups, right-leaning groups in the Bao Diao movement. I guess for those, and these were the majority, the left-leaning ones, basically what they did is, well, they criticized the KMT, the ROC in its response. They criticized American imperialism. They criticized Japan's renewed imperialism. But what they did is basically they replaced Taiwan ROC with PRC, with the People's Republic of China, in the imagery of what China is. And this is basically to a certain way, a way for them to overcome this identity crisis. This all has changed. So this movement, as I mentioned already, basically has died out in 19. Some of the students returned. Some of the students, Taiwanese students, moved to the mainland, China. Some of them stayed in the United States because they couldn't get back because they were persecuted by the KMT. But this whole dynamic has changed in 1990s, and today there are quite a few, pretty small groups in Taiwan. The issue has become very much, and the groups that advocate this Bao Diao, protection of Diao Tai in Taiwan, they've became actors in cross-strait politics. So basically in relations between Taiwan and China. Now, So the few groups that exist, basically, they use this issue to advocate the unity, the political and the cultural and the ethnic unity between People's Republic and Taiwan. Obviously, most of them, not all, with some exceptions, but most of these groups are pro-unification. Between Taiwan and the PRC. But the thing here is that Taiwan's identity has developed a national identity into a completely different direction. So if we look at public opinion polls, most Taiwanese identify themselves as Chinese culturally. But politically, they see Taiwan, they see themselves as very different from the PRC. And the PRC has become, for obvious reasons, or is, has been probably, the main other through which their political identity is constructed. So obviously in this context, these groups that advocate the political, not only the cultural, but also the political unity of Taiwan and the PRC, they obviously do not have much popular appeal. And therefore, and obviously the political elites and most of the parties, even the KMT today, they're very cautious. I mean, they don't advocate unification. Obviously, which if it is to happen, it would have to happen on PRC terms very much. In this context, the whole Bao Diao has very much lost its appeal. And today it's mostly a minority, very small groups that engage in this activism and they share these ideas. So quite different to the other cases, the politics and the broader identity narratives, I guess, have shaped the result of this movements and the constructs in all of the cases.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting how you're able to trace out not only, you know, a very different sort of origin story, but also an entirely different trajectory for at least the Taiwan side of this, row over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. So I want to, before I let you go here, I'm very curious about what it is that you're up to these days in your research now that this is out, or what you have planned for the future.
I think like everybody these days, I'm thinking mostly about, my mind is occupied by the ongoing corona pandemic. But the project that I've started working on recently, before the pandemic, is on Japan-Korea relations. So I'm interested in looking into the history of bilateral relations, post-war relations. I noticed that there's not much, there's quite a lot of works on the various issues, on the comfort women, obviously, on the, security relations between two countries, but mostly historical memory-related issues. And they tend to focus on the 1990s onward, which it is when these issues became quite important in surfaced up in bilateral relations. But there are very few works that look at Japan-Korea relations in the post-war year more broadly, starting from obviously 1950s onwards. So this is my next project, and I will try to use maybe some of the terms and the methodology I used in this book to focus more broadly on more narrowly at the same time on Japan-Korea relations in the post-war period.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating, and I think that's I'll be looking forward to getting that sort of longer perspective, not just focusing on the 90s to the present. And hopefully, if you have a book coming out about that in a couple of years down the road, we'll be able to have you back on the podcast. But for now, I just wanted to thank you so much for being generous with your time today and joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Nathan. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.